This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Now, I don't know how many of you out there have ever caught yourself crossing your room to pick something up and then getting halfway there and forgetting what you were going to get. Or maybe you've lost your car in a parking lot somewhere. Or maybe you've just forgotten someone close to you's name. Memory loss is something that I think we all suffer from. But did you know that research tells us that Alzheimer's and dementia is more a matter of lifestyle and health choices than it is of biology? Today on the program, Jim's going to be talking with Dr. Gary Small from UCLA's Longevity Center, talking about how a lot of the same habits that lead to a healthy heart are also the same habits that lead to a healthy mind. So if you've ever caught yourself forgetting something in the middle of what you were doing, listen up, guys, because today on the program, some tips from Dr. Gary Small on keeping that memory sharp.
All right. Well, this week we're going to talk about the new normal and its impact on retirement. If you look at it, three decades ago, a lot of individuals working in the private sector had defined benefit pension plans, kind of like what you see in the government. Many of those defined benefit plans went to the wayside. Most of them are gone. Then in the 80s and 90s, well, we had high interest rates. I mean, think about it. In 1981, interest rates were at 15%, and they remained fairly high, even in the high single-digit range. And we also had rising stock prices for two decades. You look at where we are today. One-year Treasury bills, less than 0.1%. The Fed keeping the Fed funds rate at 0 to 0.25%. And here's one that'll really grab you. 5 years ago, you could have got 5% on a two-year Treasury note. Today, you're lucky if you got 0.3%. 6 years ago, we had higher interest rates. And 6 years ago, the Fed took interest rates to zero, and we've been at zero interest rates for 6 years. Judging by this week's FOMC meeting, there was one clear message. The Fed may be tapering, but the other side of that message, clear and loud, they intend to keep interest rates low for a very extended period of time.
This broad assessment will not hinge on any one or two indicators, but will take into account a wide range of information, including measures of labor market conditions, indicators of inflation pressures and inflation expectations, and readings on financial developments. Based on its current assessment of these factors, the committee anticipates that it likely will be appropriate to maintain the current target range for the federal funds rate for a considerable time after the asset purchase program ends, especially if projected inflation continues to run below the committee's 2% longer-run goal and longer-term inflation expectations remain well anchored.
That was a clip of Janet Yellen from her press conference following the FOMC meeting, but if you heard in that clip, there was a clear message the Fed chairman was trying to get out. We're going to keep interest rates low for a long period of time. Now, obviously, that's going to have an impact on your retirement. So what we want to do today is share a case study that deals with several of the issues that are probably on your mind. Number one, the things that you're afraid of. You know, what about if interest rates go up? What about if inflation goes up? What if they keep interest rates longer than I expected? And what if I outlive my assets? And number two, the impact of this of having no plan. Now, the things that people are afraid of are pretty straightforward. I mean, take a look at the stuff that we've gone through here in the last decade or so. We've seen inflation go up. Think oil prices going from $20 a barrel to $150. And even on this Friday, they're at $107. Outliving your assets. One of the things we know with medical technology, people are spending 20 to 25 years in their retirement. So almost a quarter of their adult life. And also, there's talk about changes to Social Security and Medicare. Just think how Obamacare is changing Medicare itself. Or if you think back about Social Security, it used to be tax-free. Then they tax 50% of it. Then they're taxing 85% of it. What if they start phasing it out? And then, of course, we're dealing with low interest rate environment. where you see treasury notes, treasury bills at rates that we never thought we'd see in our lifetime. And then also, with longevity, we have to deal with the cost of incapacity.
All these things, Jim, create a lot of challenges for people facing retirement, especially those who are already in retirement. And maybe when they entered retirement, the investing landscape and the return landscape looked dramatically different than it does now. I'm thinking about a couple, Tom and Sue Turner, that we're aware of, that when Tom retired back in 2002, obviously things were a lot different back then. You know, he had a very sizable personal portfolio, also had a very sizable rollover IRA when he retired. At the time, it made sense for them to put roughly half of their overall assets into some bond funds. Now, Jim, at that time, the bond funds they selected were paying them roughly 6% in terms of interest rates. And they decided to go ahead and put roughly the other 50%, which was mostly in Tom's IRA, into a stock portfolio. Now, this whole 50-50 split between bonds and stocks at that time was a pretty typical allocation plan for someone just starting out in retirement. And you and I have talked several times on the show, Jim, about some of the shortfalls that sort of come to the fore with some of these cookie-cutter retirement plans. But again, at the time, 50% in bonds, 50% in stocks, pretty typical allocation being recommended to someone who was in retirement. They had some Social Security coming in as well. So they start off their retirement. Again, they've got a really nice portfolio. Social Security's coming in. Things are rolling along. They really didn't have a plan. And the problem with not having a plan is that the no plan works until it doesn't work. And this is exactly what happened to Tom and Sue. You know, they panicked in 2008, 2009. They sold out of all their stock funds. Then we had the flash crash happen in 2010. So what used to be a $1.2 million IRA stock portfolio went all the way down to $920,000. So at that point during the flash crash, they decided, okay, we've had enough. We just can't stand this volatility anymore. They decided to go ahead and put their money with a different advisor. Now, at that time, they had about $600,000 still left in their bond funds, about $200,000 left in the CDs at the bank, and then they had the IRA portfolio that had gone from $1.2 million down to $720,000 during the 2008-2009 crash, came back up again, and again, decided to just cut their losses at $920,000 in their stock portfolio during the flash crash. Now, obviously, over the years, you know, from 2002 to 2010, the investment landscape changed dramatically. Things changed dramatically in terms of the way the world was working and things were functioning. You know, when they came to us, they had some pretty big concerns. And those concerns really related a lot to, as you were saying, Jim, outliving the assets. Again, just the returns they were getting were far lower than expected. The yield on their bond funds was way, way down. So the income they were used to receiving back in 2002 was just dramatically reduced. Again, inflation, costs of living have been creeping up, and they just weren't having enough income to meet those inflated costs of living. And the other thing, too, is they were starting to realize that healthcare was going to be a lot bigger expense than they had originally thought it was going to be. So this is sort of the problem that they ran into, is that they didn't really have a solid plan for their assets, and so they kept panicking over and over again and making these sort of knee-jerk reaction decisions with their portfolios, and it sort of got them into a little bit of a tight spot.
On the healthcare front, I guess the good news with the Turners is just before Tom retired, they bought a long-term care policy. So if one of them ends up going into a long-term care facility, at least they have a spare tire or a long-term care policy to take care of that. But the main problem, Kathleen, were the investment fears and outliving their assets. And also somewhat a reluctance and fear of markets and, quite honestly, financial advisors. And Tom's problem was a lot of the websites he was going to were always talking about the next market crash, the next dollar collapse. And so Tom was always looking for the next crisis. So in 2010, when he went to a well-known advisor, one of the problems is that advisor put most of their assets in foreign stocks over fears of a dollar crash. Well, as we all know, looking back, unfortunately, they lost another $150,000 in their assets. The dollar did not crash. Instead, it went up as more and more assets flowed into the U.S. markets as foreign stock markets went down. Think of the pig country crisis in 2010 and 11, where the dollar strengthened as a result. And even worse is those bond funds that were taken out in 2002, even though they had gone up in value, the dividend had dropped every year. Interest rates began to come down in the 2001 recession when Greenspan brought the federal funds rate down to 1%, and then also during the financial crisis following 2007 and 2009, when the Fed brought interest rates down to their low levels where they are today, the bond funds dropped their income every single year. And so not only were the bond funds cutting their dividends, but all of these, whether it was the stock market crash, whether it was low interest rates, the news about trillion-dollar deficits, quantitative easing, a possible dollar crash, turned Tom into a permabear in looking always for the worst-case outcome, in which case he almost became an ostrich, afraid to do anything because he thought maybe the next crash was right around the corner.
And I think this is continuing, Jim. I'm seeing this with a lot of people sort of panicking about FATCA. A lot of those provisions going to affect July 1. I've been getting calls about that too. Again, people just always expecting the next shoe to drop, the next big crisis to happen. So again, Jim, when we're talking about money, part of what we're talking about here is dealing with fear. You know, what's this fear about this next big crash? Fear about the market, fear about having enough money to make it. So let's just recap some of the fears that were on Tom and Sue Turner's minds when we met with them. Again, their biggest concern was outliving their assets because of the returns they were getting were lower, the interest rates they were getting were lower, their cost of living kept going up. Again, they were expecting medical expenses to keep being more and more a part of their cost of living, which they really hadn't been planning on before. So why don't we talk about how we dealt with some of their concerns, Jim?
Well, the first issue that I reminded them and congratulated them, their long-term care policies really took one of the biggest fears that they had, that one of them would go or end up in a long-term care facility, especially since it ran on one side of the family. But the main problem were investment fears, which means given the low rate of return they seen with their bond funds, what happened to the stock market, there was always this fear of outliving assets and, of course, market advisors. And the thing that I guess consumed Tom going to all these what I call doomsday sites was he was always looking for the next crisis. In 2010, he thought he went to an advisor fearing a dollar crash. Unfortunately, the dollar didn't crash, and those foreign stocks went down while U.S. stocks went up. So there was the issue there where he lost another six figures in his IRA portfolio. The dollar went up, not down. Foreign stocks went down. And even worse, during the same period of time, another source of his income, CD rates, and the dividends on his bond funds continued to go down. So Tom turned into a doomsday believer. And that is something that prevented him from making rational decisions because there was no plan in place. It was whatever the headlines were, if it was the fiscal cliff, if it was the sequester, if it was Syria, whatever happened, the debt ceiling debate in 2011, the downgrading of U.S. debt, the pig country crisis, all of these things were headlines. And what he failed to recognize was the valuation of stocks, companies buying back stocks, quantitative easing, the stimulus that was being poured into the economy, and how money and the slowdown in emerging markets, which dropped commodity prices, benefiting the U.S. markets, and the downturn in the emerging markets. So a lot of this fear that he was getting from a lot of these sites prevented him from actually hearing another point of view, and of course, without a plan, what he found himself doing was becoming reactive rather than proactive.
And Jim, you and I talk about this quite a bit, which is the fact that if you don't understand what each portion of your portfolio is supposed to do, you don't have a strategy for it, it's really easy to sort of lurch from crisis to crisis in terms of always being reactionary in your portfolio. So why don't we talk about how we actually walked the Turners through a plan, which they really hadn't had before, and how that sort of calmed their fears and helped get their portfolio and their income stream back on track.
Well, the first thing, and if you're listening to this program, you know exactly where I'm going with this, was we put together a budget. And we tried to get the Turners to think into two categories. Let's take everything that you're spending money on a daily basis. We're going to call that the base budget, the essentials. That's the must-haves. Then let's take a look at the things that are discretionary. You know, maybe gifts to grandchildren, vacations, luxuries, maybe a new car. And when we took a look at it, where they were currently standing, they had a shortfall roughly of about $1,000 a month, which is one reason they were getting nervous given the size of their assets. You know, folks, who would ever thought being a millionaire is really not being a millionaire when you think about the purchasing power of money today? So they knew about their shortfall. And so their income strategy of cash and bonds was not working. The dividends were being cut on the bond funds. And of course, I don't need to tell you folks, if you have your money at a bank, the bank's paying you nothing. But the worst part, half of the problem was taking them through the stock market. And I took them through the dividend drill. And that was a tough one to overcome. We started with dividend income. And we talked about the issues of, look, Coca-Cola stock can fluctuate, Exxon stock can fluctuate, but during the entire financial crisis, most of the companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, with the exception of the financial companies like the banks, increased their dividends. Coca-Cola increased their dividend in 2008. They increased it in 2009. So what we did is we started out with a portfolio, and I showed them on a graph what happened to Coca-Cola stock. I said, you know, had you walked in this office January 1st, 2008 and bought Coca-Cola, yes, you would have been down by March of 2009. But in 2008, Coca-Cola increased its dividend. 2009 increased its dividend. So did Exxon. And by the fall of 2010, Coca-Cola was back to where it started from. So we got Tom to focus on the dividend increases. And we also told him that was very important, which was much, much different because we moved into a laddered bond portfolio, that his income wasn't going to change like it did in the bond fund. So we helped him through the process and say, look, here's what's going to happen. The most important thing is we got them to begin to focus on their budget and the relationship of that portfolio in providing the income for that budget. The fixed income laddered bond portfolio, the interest rates would not change. The stock portfolio, the dividends from a lot of these blue chip stocks would not be going down, even though the stock price might fluctuate. It would be going up. And then the other thing is communication. This plan we did at the beginning of 2013, and of course our first major hurdle was in May of 2013 when the Fed first announced tapering, where we got a 7% correction in the market. And through communication, through our newsletter, we basically said, look, you know, this is a correction. The economy is still growing. These companies are still increasing their dividends. In fact, it's helpful when you have a nice dividend portfolio. There's always a dividend increase coming almost every single quarter from one of the companies in the portfolio. So rather than focusing on where the stock price was temporarily, we got Tom to start focusing on, this is what your dividend income is. And oh, by the way, this month, X company just raised their dividend. So what we did is we addressed the issue of the bond funds and CDs with laddered bond portfolio, because here's one of their main problems. Between 2002 and 2013, the income from those two major asset categories, cash, CDs, and bonds, went from $45,000 to $18,000. CD income went from 5% to almost 0.5%, and that was a loss of income of $26,000. So we moved the bonds into laddered bonds at 4.5%, CDs to laddered bonds at the same, and the income went from $19,000 to $36,000, an increase of $17,000. So instead of a deficit of almost $11,000 a year, they now had a surplus of almost $6,000. And we took care of this extra income, which would really pay for a lot of the motorhome travel and a lot of the things that they'd like to do in what we call the lifestyle or the want-to-have budget. But more importantly, we assured them that their basic budget of necessities would always be taken care of.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the emotional state of the Turners as well? We've talked about how Mr. Turner in particular was very fearful. He was expecting doom to happen, financial crisis to happen. Why don't we talk a little bit about where they're at now and what do you think made a difference for the Turners in terms of their comfort level with their portfolio and their comfort level with their income?
I would say, Kathleen, there were probably three things that factored in here. Number one, we now had a plan. Number two, they were now convinced that even though, you know, Coca-Cola stock could go up or down or Exxon, their income was not affected by the market correction, which is what happened to them in the past. When stocks went down, they weren't getting regular dividends from their stock funds, especially the foreign stock funds that one advisor put them in, and then also the bond funds. So the other thing is we now had inflation protection. They saw, and they've seen it with monthly distributions and quarterly distributions, the increase in their income that was coming in with predictable income from their bonds and also dividend increases from their stocks. So I would say three things. We had a plan. Two, they began to realize that their income was not going to be affected, and three, they now saw that they had an inflation protection built into their plan, where previously, you could have said when they were in stock funds, it was inflationary. But then again, we had those downturns. What they began to realize is even though stocks may go down, the dividends in a lot of these companies kept going up.
I think a lot of this, Jim, is just, again, about understanding what each portion of your portfolio is for, and that when you're talking about these dividend-paying stocks, even though the actual value of the stocks goes up and down in the market, that's always going to be the case. No stock is going to always go straight up. But the dividend payouts, that's what you're really focusing on. That's kind of what you had to train Tom to focus on, was the dividend payout rather than the stock valuation. Just thinking about the Turners, is just, they're very typical of a lot of the retirees today. Most retirees don't have a plan for retirement. They don't have a financial plan in place. Or maybe they put all their eggs in one basket, whether that's cash or it's bonds, maybe it's foreign stocks or gold, whatever it is. Or maybe they're just not appropriately allocated for their actual income needs. And what this really does, Jim, is when you don't have a plan, again, you don't have any roots to hang on to. So you sort of get blown to and fro by different media hype, and every little financial up or down that happens, it feels like a mountain to you instead of a molehill, because you don't have an anchor to keep you grounded as far as what's going on with your specific portfolio. So you tend to operate from a place of completely irrational fear, which is understandable. I mean, this is money. This is how you make ends meet. This is how you survive. Of course, it's something you should be concerned about and be worried about. But not having a plan, Jim, means that you sort of are ripe to fall prey to sort of fear-mongering rhetoric in the newsletter writing community and in the news media community. And so you tend to start to buy and sell and make portfolio decisions based on fear instead of on an actual rational plan. And so I think the big benefit to the Turners emotionally, which is huge in retirement, is to be emotionally comfortable as well as financially comfortable. The huge change for them was the dependability and understanding the piece of each of their portfolio, what each piece was supposed to do. So for Tom, understanding that the laddered bonds, again, would help deal with this reducing income he had been experiencing with the bond funds, the laddered bonds would help keep his income nice and steady. The stocks, hopefully over time, would be growing to sort of keep up with inflation, and also the income from those stocks would hopefully keep growing to keep up with inflation. So instead of their income constantly going down and down and down, they're in a situation where a portion of their income is staying nice and steady to provide for those absolute necessities. Another portion of their income is growing over time. So essentially what we did is to deal with their fears by showing them the direct link between the different parts of their portfolio and specific parts of their budget. And the other thing is too, Jim, as you were mentioning, again, as we've talked about, the market does go up and down. So when there is a big up or down in the market, we keep our investors educated. We let them know what we think caused that particular up or down. We let them know what our indicators are telling us about the overall market health and market direction. And so since that time, since they've come on board with us, they felt more emotionally comfortable with what's happening in the market because we help them understand what's actually going on. And again, Jim, I just can't help but repeat that the best way to deal with your fears, the best way to handle understanding your portfolio, is to actually have a plan, especially in retirement, so you understand why your portfolio is doing what it's doing.
And speaking of retirement, we're going to talk about one of the big issues, and you're really going to want to listen to this interview with Dr. Gary Small from the Longevity Center at UCLA. He's written several books on memory loss, also dealing with Alzheimer's, and I think one of the most comforting facts that you're going to hear in this interview is 75% of the issues dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's are lifestyle related rather than hereditary. So if you have a relative, a parent, or somebody that's experienced this, there's some good news, folks. And even when you have a hereditary problem, if caught and diagnosed early, you can extend, you can solve part of it. But more importantly, with lifestyle changes, the same thing that make you healthy for heart healthy, for cancer, a lot of these things are all related. Good diets, exercise, the relief of stress, and there's even things you can do. You know, we think about exercising our bodies, jogging, lifting weights, yoga, Pilates, all these things. Have you ever thought about exercising your brain? I know on my wife's side, both her mother and her grandmother lived to ripe old ages. and both of them were bridge masters. Think of what that does for stimulating the brain and memory of becoming a bridge master. So we're going to talk about that with Dr. Gary Small coming up right after this. One of the great things about the advancement of medicine, it's allowing individuals to live longer. They're spending more of their years in retirement. But there are some side effects to that: loss of memory, diseases of the brain such as Alzheimer's and dementia. Joining us on the program is Dr. Gary Small. He's professor of psychiatry and aging at UCLA. And doctor, you know, it is thought of that a lot of the diseases that we see today of the brain, whether it's dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's, is hereditary. If you had a parent or a relative that had it, it was likely that you would have it. You've written a couple books called Alzheimer's Prevention Program that talks about that a lot of this is also lifestyle related more so than it is hereditary. Let's talk about that.
For the average person, genetics, what you inherit from your parents, is less important than how you decide to live your life every day. And we learned this from the MacArthur study of successful aging and other studies. And what I focused on in my books are ways to empower people to take control of their brain health as they age, because there's compelling scientific evidence that there is a lot we can do to help stave off symptoms of Alzheimer's.
You know, this is rather unique in the sense that, you know, we think about our health. We think about diet. We think about going out, exercising, getting a treadmill, going for walks. We don't think about exercising the brain. So when you talk about exercising the brain, let's talk about what that entails. I know that, you know, if I go for a walk, if I lift weights, if I do Pilates, all those things are great for the body. But how do you exercise the brain?
You know, it turns out that all those things are also exercising the brain. When you take a walk, you're pumping oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells. You're actually getting your body to produce chemicals that get your brain cells to sprout branches and to talk to each other better. So a lot of people don't realize what's good for your heart, what's good for your body, is also good for your brain. But we can augment that by doing specific mental exercises. There's a lot of studies showing that if you keep your mind stimulated, those brain cells are going to be functioning better.
So, for example, keeping the brain stimulated, my wife's grandmother lived to be like 97, 98, but she was a bridge master. So playing bridge stimulated the brain. Is it things like that, learning a foreign language, doing something different that causes the brain to exercise itself?
That's what the evidence suggests, that if you can expose yourself to new experiences, change things up, travel, play games, have conversations, stay connected socially, all these kinds of activities will keep your brain cells happy and stave off symptoms of Alzheimer's.
You know, one of the things that we've seen in the commercial arena are websites that have come out like Lumosity, that develop specific types of exercises that stimulate the brain. Can we talk about that and what these exercises are actually doing?
Based on the study showing a connection between mental stimulation and better brain health, there are a lot of games that have been developed by companies like Lumosity, Dacom, Posit Science, and others. And some of these programs have been studied systematically, and they show that you can improve your memory over so many months as a result of playing these games. Scientists at UCLA did a study of Dacom brain fitness and found that over several months, memory would improve. But not all the games have been tested systematically. So we're not sure if they do that much in terms of memory in the short term. And in the long term, there's not absolute proof that playing these games will definitely protect your brain health.
So given the studies that you have done at your institute there at UCLA, number one, what led you to the conclusion that more of what happens to our brain health is lifestyle related than, let's say, genetics?
That's really based on large-scale studies like the MacArthur study of successful aging and other studies. At UCLA, we've certainly studied brain scanning tools and found that people who are healthier in their lifestyle have less physical evidence of Alzheimer's in their brain. Scientists at Washington University in St. Louis have found that people who exercise more have less Alzheimer's amyloid plaque in their brain, even if they have a genetic risk for Alzheimer's. And we've done studies of identical twins, and we find that the twin that lives a healthier lifestyle is much less likely to develop Alzheimer's than the one who does not.
Doctor, can you define that healthier lifestyle? One can think of, let's say, eating properly, having a good, well-balanced diet instead of junk food, exercising. What other things incorporate or define a healthy lifestyle?
I'd put it into four major categories: physical exercise, mental stimulation and exercise, good nutrition, and stress management.
And what role does stress play in brain disease?
We know that in animal studies, chronic stress not only impairs memory, but it actually shrinks the hippocampal memory centers of the brain. And in humans, if you inject a volunteer with the stress hormone cortisol, you find that there's temporary impairment in memory. Our scientists have looked at the effects of different relaxation techniques like meditation or Tai Chi, and they find that it not only improves mood and memory, but also rewires brain function. So there's a lot to be said about trying to manage stress. We can't eliminate it completely, but we can deal with it more effectively.
Now, in your book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, could you define the series of steps that you laid out in your book that an individual can take to either delay the onset of that disease or prevent it completely?
So it involves changing behavior, and it's hard to change behavior because you've got to develop habits. And what we did in the book was to create a one-week program to make it easy for people, to get them started, to help them develop these habits, to get up and to do some stretching and some strength training and some physical exercise, and to intersperse different forms of mental stimulation, and to go beyond that and teach memory techniques to compensate for age-related cognitive losses. And on top of that, to teach people how to plan their diet, so it optimizes brain function and helps them to reduce stress.
I know that when you talk about heart disease and other factors, there are certain kind of diets, a lot of fruits, vegetables, things like broccoli. Is it similar for brain health as well?
The brain healthy diet is a Mediterranean style diet where there are lots of fruits and vegetables that fight oxidative stress that can cause wear and tear on the brain. There are omega-3 fats that are anti-inflammatory and consumed by eating fish, nuts, and flaxseed. Also, we discourage people from eating too much refined sugar in processed foods and to try to minimize the omega-6 fats from whole milk and red meat products.
So a lot of the things it sounds like that make for a heart-healthy diet apply to the brain as well.
That's true, and you find that those who live around the Mediterranean, there are several examples of people living a long, healthy life.
I know Dr. Dean Ornish has talked about extending life through stress management, through, let's say, yoga, through breathing techniques, deep breathing. There are a number of things that we're finding that have been around for a long time. We're just finding now that they make people healthier.
And it's important for people to experiment with different approaches. We find, for example, a lot of Westerners are uncomfortable meditating. They get restless. It's hard for them to sit for long periods of time. But they prefer doing something active like Tai Chi, where there are physical poses that go along with stress reduction and relaxation.
And are things that you can do, for example, somebody that's retired has a lot of free time, they can focus on exercise. What about an active individual, somebody that is on the go, you know, flying around the world, late night appointments? Are there things that they can do throughout the day to reduce stress? For example, maybe sitting in a chair and taking 10 deep breaths?
Not only can they do that throughout the day and it can make a big difference in their lives, but they can use their smartphone to set an alarm to tell them now it's time to get off the computer and take a break. They can also be mindful of using the stairs and trying to walk between appointments to do things that intersperse their aerobic conditioning and the stress management throughout the day and make it easier to achieve all they want to do with their busy lifestyle and still manage their brain health.
Doctor, what about doing something that totally challenges the brain in a different direction? Let's say you're an engineer, you're very technically oriented, analytically oriented, you're an accountant, you're in finance, taking up something like a foreign language, bridge, music, or doing something, you know, taking up finger painting or something totally different than what you're used to in your daily routine.
I think it's great to try to shake things up and try new things, but also you want it to be fun. There's a principle of training but not straining the brain. So if you find that foreign languages are just too difficult, don't pursue that. Pursue something that you enjoy. Maybe you're someone who just takes daily walks and you want to change things up and try playing tennis or racquetball so you have a competitive sport. So I think it's a question of keeping in mind what you enjoy, because if you don't enjoy it and it's tedious, you're not going to continue it. It's not about being healthy for a week or 2 weeks or a month. It's about changing your everyday habits for the rest of your life.
Yeah, changing your lifestyle. If you were to boil it down to two or three simple things that you can do that would have the greatest impact on brain health, what would that be?
I would say take a brisk 20-minute walk every day. Make sure that you remain socially engaged and not isolated. And try to eat healthy. Try not to overeat. And choose the right kinds of foods to balance your health and make you feel better right away.
And is there anything that really stands out when it comes to food? I mean, you used to hear this. I don't know if it's a wives' tale. Carrots are great for your eyesight. Is there anything great for brain health?
You know, there's so many brain-healthy foods. One that does stand out is fish, because of the omega-3 fats that fight inflammation. We think a lot of the problem with brain aging and Alzheimer's has to do with an inflamed brain. The challenge, though, with fish is that it has mercury. And you can't eat it every day or else you run the risk of accumulating mercury in your body, which has side effects. So if you want to eat fish, that's great, but balance that with nuts, which also have omega-3 fats.
And doctor, let's talk about dementia and Alzheimer's. What are the things that a spouse or a loved one should be aware of in trying to detect it in a loved one? What are the beginning signs of it, if I may ask?
It's challenging to recognize the beginning signs of Alzheimer's because they're very much like normal aging. So I think it's when these kinds of everyday memory slips, forgetting someone's name, forgetting where you put things, forgetting plans and so forth, become more frequent and more severe. And if there's a concern, it's always best to be conservative and check with the doctor, because we find that the earlier you detect it and start treating it, the better the outcome.
That was my next question. So let's say that there are the beginning signs of either dementia or Alzheimer's. Are there corrective steps if caught early, like we know with heart disease and cancer? It's treatable and maybe even curable?
We don't have a cure yet, but we do have medicines that help with the symptoms. And I find in my own practice, when I combine this healthy lifestyle regimen along with the standard medical treatment, people do very well.
Well, doctor, as we close, can you tell our listeners about your books? You have two of them, the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, and then also the Memory Prescription.
Well, actually, we're working on our seventh book, and there are a number of others, like the Memory Bible and the Longevity Bible. There's even a book called iBrain about how technology affects our brain, and The Other Side of the Couch, which describes my most unusual cases as a psychiatrist over the years. But people who are interested in brain health and trying to stave off symptoms of Alzheimer's, I strongly recommend the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, because it's the most up-to-date, the most recent compilation of the scientific evidence in a way that's accessible and readable, thanks to my co-author and wife, Gigi Borgen.
Well, listen, doctor, as we close, once again, the name of the books?
Well, I recommend the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. That'll help keep your brain young and healthy for as long as possible. And if you're interested in unusual psychiatric cases and learning about psychiatry and psychology, try The Other Side of the Couch.
Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. You know, the great news about all of this is a lot of things that we have taken for granted. Well, like you have hereditary conditions, as you talk about in your book, a lot of this could be prevented through being proactive and how one leads one's lifestyle.
That's right. I think people have a lot of hope, and we have more control than we realize.
All right, Doctor, all the best to you. Keep up the great work.
Thank you for your interest.
You know, one of the things that we're finding with medicine, if you've listened to Lifetime Income over the last 2 weeks, we've had two doctors on the program, Dr. Drew Collins last week, who had some great news. There are things that you can do to reverse heart disease. I mean, just take a look at President Bill Clinton today. And he also said that in the next 5 years, some of the breakthroughs that are going to be coming with heart disease are going to be phenomenal, helping us to live even longer. And of course, now with Dr. Small, you read his book. He talks about there are so many things that you can do when it comes to dementia and Alzheimer's that are preventable. Your lifestyle in simple things, exercise, diet, and just stress management, whether it's going for a walk, meditation, doing yoga, Tai Chi, as the doctor mentioned, there are a number of things that you can do. The important thing is you worked hard all your life to get to that day of retirement. You want to be able to enjoy it by staying healthy. Here's just another way you can do so, keeping your brain healthy. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this week's Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.